Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. In a little-noticed piece of news, Ukraine's Deputy Foreign Minister Vadim Pristaiko said on an interview this week that his country is willing to risk nuclear war with Russia over the ongoing conflict in the region. Specifically, Pristaiko said, "Everybody is afraid of fighting with a nuclear state. We are not anymore in Ukraine. However dangerous it sounds, we have to stop Russian President Vladimir Putin somehow." The conflict in the Ukraine has reared prospects of a second Cold War with Russia backing separatist rebels inside Ukraine, while the US and Europe support a nascent government in Kiev. It was not long ago that the specter of mutual nuclear annihilation overwhelmed global discourse, and brinksmanship was all that remained between survival and mass extinction. But in all of history, the US has been the only nation to actually deploy nuclear weapons. In fact, this year marks the 70th anniversary of the US bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Joining me now to put current events into historical context is Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's the author of Beyond the Laboratory, Scientists as Political Activists in 1930s America, co-author with Akira Kimura of Rethinking the Atomic Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives, and he's collaborated with filmmaker Oliver Stone to co-author the 12-part Showtime documentary film series and book, both titled The Untold History of the United States. Welcome to Uprising, Peter.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how serious is the situation in the Ukraine currently? Most of the commentators we've spoken with say that Cold War fears are vastly overstated. And then, of course, the Ukrainian official says he's willing to risk nuclear war with Russia this week. Does that change things?
No, I don't think it really does change things. Vladimir Putin would not be reckless enough to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. Nor would he have any need to do so. If Russia wanted to go to war against Ukraine, their conventional forces are certainly more than adequate to defeat the Ukrainian army. We saw what the Ukrainians were able to do against these disorganized rebels in southeastern Ukraine. So there's not really any threat to Russia in a military sense posed by Ukraine. But this kind of bluster is dangerous, and the situation in Ukraine is dangerous. You have to remember that the United States and Russia still have hundreds of nuclear missiles pointed at each other with thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. So this is a certain kind of insanity that still has infected the world that began with the nuclear bombings in 1945 that has never abated since then. So we still now have 16,300 nuclear weapons around the world. And it's a very dangerous situation.
How much more dangerous is the situation today than, say, during the height of the Cold War? I mean, during that time, it felt like, or it seemed like, at least from historical documents, I wasn't there at the time, but it seemed as though the risk of nuclear annihilation was something that people lived with and felt palpably and feared. But we don't even really talk about it very much anymore. Are we more safe now than we were back then?
Yes and no. The threat of a full-scale nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at each other, that threat has somewhat abated. Mm-hmm. Quantitative sense, it's definitely abated. And in an actual menacing sense of an imminent threat of that kind of nuclear war, certainly the possibility has been reduced. You have to remember that at the height of the Cold War, the United States and the Soviets had 70,000 nuclear weapons. And it was estimated that they had the destructive capability of 1.5 million Hiroshima bombs. So as our species really was insane, with 1.5 million Hiroshima bombs, what did we need that for? How many times do we have to be able to kill everybody on the planet over and over again before we're satisfied? That number has been reduced to 16,300. So in a quantitative sense, the numbers have diminished. But in terms of real threats, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has its doomsday clock, which it corrects every few years depending on the threat of nuclear war. And it recently moved the doomsday clock 2 minutes ahead to say that we're 3 minutes from midnight, which means that the Nobel laureates, who are members of the board who determine the hands on the nuclear clock, think that the threat of nuclear war is actually increasing and increasing dramatically. The worst they ever had it was 2 minutes to midnight. Now it's 3 minutes to midnight. So it might not be the full-scale nuclear war we had nightmares about at the height of the Cold War, but still the possibility of nuclear war exists. And what we understand more and more is the dangers of nuclear winter. The estimate is that even a very limited regional nuclear war in which 100 nuclear weapons were used would threaten the lives of 2 billion people, the effects of which would be felt for at least 10 years. A larger nuclear war still could threaten to wipe out all life on the planet. Not that the bombs have to kill everybody, but the environmental effects of the nuclear bombings would have that devastating effect, create nuclear winter, cut off the sun, destroy the crops. People would starve to death, a miserable, miserable death for most people on the planet.
Now, of course, this year, as I said, is the 70th anniversary of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, and the U.S. has been the only country to drop, and in that case, two bombs, over 100,000 people killed, and the fallout, continues. How did that horror change the course of history, and how do you respond to those who still defend it, saying that had we not killed that many people at the time, we would have risked killing far more, and it was that which ended the war, etc.?
This is one of the things that we go into great detail on in our Untold History of the United States. It's a very important issue that I've been writing about for two decades now. The reality was that the atomic bombs, the excuse that was used by American officials, Stimson and others who wrote about this, and Truman's statements, was that we dropped the atomic bombs in order to avoid an invasion. That the United States was going to have to invade Japan. The invasion, Truman writes in his memoirs, that Marshall told him it would cost 500,000 American lives. Stimson talks about 1 million American casualties. That's the myth. The reality was that the United States knew that that Japanese were already defeated, that the Japanese were trying to get better surrender terms, including keeping the emperor, that the thing that the Japanese feared the most was the Soviet invasion, that they wrote about this repeatedly, that the Soviets were due to invade in early August. And so and what finally ends the war is not the atomic bombing, it's the Soviet invasion of Manchuria. As the Japanese prime minister says, tomorrow they'll be in Hokkaido. Japan, the essence of Japan will be destroyed. We have to surrender now before we surrender to the Soviets and the Soviets take over Japan. So that was the thinking of the Japanese at the time. The Americans knew that. Truman knew that. It's explicit in our policy statements that the thing that the Japanese fear the most is Soviet invasion. The Soviet invasion will convince Japan that further resistance is unnecessary, that defeat is inevitable. And the Japanese knew that. So the other thing about the atomic bombing, the United States had already proven that it could wipe out Japanese cities. We firebombed over 100 Japanese cities. Destruction reached 99.5% in the city of Toyama. The Japanese leaders had accepted that the United States could wipe out cities. The big issue to them was not whether it was one plane and one bomb or 200 planes and thousands of bombs. It was the fact that they accepted we could wipe out cities. So the atomic bombings, in that sense, didn't change the equation. What did change the equation was the Soviet invasion. Now that undermined Japan's military strategy, its Ketsugen military strategy. It undermined its diplomatic strategy because they've been trying to get the Soviets to intervene to get them better surrender terms, to get them to keep the emperor, essentially. Most Americans don't realize that six of America's seven five-star admirals and generals who got their fifth star during the war are on record as saying the atomic bombs were either militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, or in many cases, both. So we're talking about MacArthur, we're talking about Eisenhower, we're talking about Leahy, we're talking about the top Japanese leaders.
Now, Peter, how did the legacy of those bombings change Japan's own approach to war? I mean, you would think that it would have changed the U.S.'s approach to one of never again, since our government was the one that actually perpetrated these. But, of course, we have kept our imperialism strong, and it was really Japan who changed the way it approached the whole world in terms of foreign policy.
Interestingly enough, it was during the U.S. occupation, and it was MacArthur and his staff who helped draft Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, which makes Japan having a peace constitution. Article 9 says the Japanese nation renounces the use of war as a tool of foreign policy or even the threat of war. So Japan becomes the most peaceful nation in the world. It says we can't maintain offensive nuclear forces, and Japan holds on to that view. In fact, the Japanese people embraced it. During the Korean War, the United States had second thoughts and wanted to change the Japanese Constitution so that Japan could help with the United States in Korea. However, the Japanese people and their leaders resisted American pressure to change the peace constitution. Unfortunately, now the Abe administration, an extreme right-wing nationalist administration that runs Japan, is trying to change Article 9. They've already supported collective self-defense. They're now trying to officially undo Article 9 so that Japan can maintain offensive military forces and work with the United States in many parts of the world. Sadly, it was Obama who helped put Abe into power. The Japanese Democratic Party was elected, and Hatoyama was elected on basically a peace platform to a large extent. But one of the fundamental issues was that he was opposed to the relocation of the U.S. Marine base from Futenma to Hinoko on Okinawa, and Obama insisted that they relocate the Marine base to Hinoko, as the previous government had agreed to, and Obama came in there and smashed Hatoyama, effectively undermined his credibility, forced him to capitulate to the United States, and then that leads to the weakness of the Japan Democratic Party and return to power of the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, the conservative forces, who Obama was sadly much more comfortable in dealing with. And that's what got us this right-wing Abe administration in Japan.
Right, which is now turning back some of the aspects of the peace constitution. But I'm glad you brought up Obama, because when President Obama became president initially, he started his early years as wanting to draw down nuclear weapons around the world and the stockpiles. He made a major speech, and it really heartened a lot of anti-nuclear activists. What happened to that? We hardly ever hear about it anymore.
Obama's Prague speech was actually a very, very positive statement, and he called for eliminating nuclear weapons, abolishing nuclear weapons. But even in that speech, you hear him hedging. He says it may not happen in my lifetime, certainly not in his administration. And he also effectively says that the United States is not going to be the first country to do away with its nuclear arsenal. The United States is going to be the last country to do away with its nuclear arsenal. So we had some hints there that Obama was stating a certain principle. But we were optimistic partly because Obama seemed to really believe this. Most people don't remember that Obama marched in Central Park in 1982 in that huge anti-nuclear march. 1 million people demonstrated in New York in 1982. For a nuclear freeze and eventually abolition of nuclear weapons. Obama was one of them. So there was reason to assume that in this, Obama was sincere. But like in everything, or most everything else, Obama was a disappointment. And he capitulated to the more conservative voices around him, the hawkish voices, the Hillary Clintons, the other supporters, the Jones and other supporters he had, because he surrounded himself with these militarists as his advisors. And if you look now, Obama is supporting the modernization of America's nuclear forces, a policy that is going to cost $1 trillion over the next 30 years, the next three decades. And this is Obama's policy. So instead of doing away with nuclear weapons, as was required by the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the 1968 treaty, it said that the five nuclear powers, the acknowledged nuclear powers then, had to get rid of, had to move toward getting rid of their nuclear stockpiles, the United States and the others have maintained their nuclear stockpiles. And the Marshall Islands, of all countries, is suing now an international court in order to try to get the nuclear powers to agree to follow through on their commitments back in 1968.
Now, Peter, there have not been that many figures historically in U.S. politics who had the courage to openly denounce the pursuit of nuclear weapons and, at least during the Cold War, want to, you know, openly end it. And one of the people who did fulfill that description that you and Oliver Stone write about in your book and feature in your film was Henry Wallace, vice president of the U.S., a long FDR for his first term, went on to be replaced by Truman only months before FDR died. And you've written much about this chapter in U.S. history in terms of what might have been had Wallace remained FDR's running mate. How progressive was Wallace, both in the issue of war, but also social issues?
Wallace, sadly, is forgotten by most Americans today. Wallace was a visionary figure. He was Roosevelt's Secretary of Agriculture during the New Deal. In 1940, when Roosevelt was running for a third term, he wanted a real progressive on the ticket because he knew we were heading toward a war against fascism and militarism, and he chose Henry Wallace over the objections of the party bosses who were going to get their revenge back in 1944, 4 years later. And Wallace, as vice president, was a great visionary. When Henry Luce makes his speech saying the 20th century should be the American century, and the United States should dominate the world, Wallace followed that up and challenged Luce. And he says it shouldn't be the American century, but it's the century of the common man in the tradition of the American, the French, the Latin Americans, and the Russian revolutions. He calls for a worldwide people's revolution. And he says that we have to end monopolies and cartels and colonialism and exploitation, spread the fruits of science and technology around the world. And so in 44, when he was running again, he had a lot of enemies. The British and the French put pressure on Roosevelt to get him off the ticket because he's a leading spokesman against colonialism. The Southern conservatives and segregationists hated him because he's a leading spokesperson for black civil rights. The business community hated him because he was a leading spokesperson for labor. He had denounced America's fascists. He said, were those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people second? The conservatives hated him, and they waged this campaign within the Democratic Party through the party bosses to get rid of Wallace on the 1944 ticket. Despite that, Wallace almost prevailed anyway because he was the second most popular man in the United States behind Roosevelt. The day that the Democratic Convention began in Chicago, July 20th, 1944, Gallup released a poll showing that 65% of American voters said they wanted Wallace back on the ticket as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. So the party bosses had to control the convention, engineer this coup, basically, to get Wallace off the ticket and Truman on. Truman was a basic non-entity. He had been ridiculed as a senator from Pendergast, this corrupt political machine. He was not a major player. He was not in any way knowledgeable about these issues, but the bosses thought he was pliable and he would do their bidding. So they tried to get him on the ticket. In the midst of a spontaneous demonstration for Wallace, Senator Claude Pepper fights his way through the crowd. He knew that if he could get Wallace's name and nomination that first night, Wallace would sweep the convention, be back on the ticket as vice president, and then he would have been the one to become president on April 12, 1945, when Roosevelt died, instead of Truman.
And then who knows what kind of a country we might have been living in at that time and maybe today.
It could have been fundamentally, dramatically different. It would have been a battle on Wallace's part, but he was a fighter, a man of great vision and great principle. He stays on in the cabinet under Truman as secretary, well, first under Roosevelt, and then stays on for a year under Truman as Secretary of Commerce. And from that position, he wages a battle against the Cold War, and he's the leading spokesperson for the abolition of nuclear weapons. So he maintained those principles, and he would argue with Truman and convince Truman. The problem with Truman was he wasn't a committed war hawk in the sense he was not a genocidal maniac in some crazy sense. Truman was a decent guy with very little knowledge, very little backbone, who would replace reason with bluster because he realized how little he himself understood. And he surrounded himself with these hacks, the people who Roosevelt would never have turned to for advice on foreign policy. And these people were hardline anti-communists, very conservative, much more militaristic. And they pushed Truman in a direction that he was willing to go. And finally, in September of 46, he fires Wallace from the cabinet. Then the last voice against the Cold War, the last voice for nuclear disarmament, is out of the cabinet. By that point, Wallace was the last of the old New Dealers who was still in an influential position. Truman had replaced them all.
Well, Peter Kuznick, I want to thank you so much for helping us shine a light on these historical events and their relevance to what's happening today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My guest, Peter Kuznick, is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's the author of Beyond the Laboratory, Scientists as Political Activists in 1930s America, co-author with Akira Kimura of Rethinking the Atomic Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives. And of course, he's collaborated with filmmaker Oliver Stone to co-author a 12-part Showtime documentary film series and book that are both titled The Untold History of the United States. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar.